And Moses said unto the judges of Israel, slay ye every one of his men that were joined unto Baal Peor. And behold, one of the children of Israel came and brought into his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses, and in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping before the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. And when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose up from among the congregation and took a javelin in his hand. And he went after the man of Israel into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her belly. So the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. And those that died in the plague were 24,000. And the Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, hath turned my wrath away from the children of Israel, while he was zealous for my sake among them, but I consumed not the children of Israel in my jealousy. Wherefore say, behold, I give unto him my covenant of peace, and he shall have it, and his seed after him, even the covenant of an everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel. You may be seated. Mark will come forth and preach Stand Your Ground, Part 3.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning. The question that faces Christendom in general and Identity Christians in particular is, what are you going to do when faced with racial violence? Because of the Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman incident, one pastor recently declared the race war has begun. But as I've said before, the race war of black-on-white crimes has murdered, raped, and robbed over a million white victims in the last 30 years. What I'd like to hear declared is that a holy war has begun, and it can begin within our movement, because whether rightly or wrongly portrayed, the Christian Identity movement has been labeled militant and radical. But I prefer the moniker of zealous for the word of truth. A zealous Christian is not someone who is prone to violence, but is no one's doormat and discriminates who walks through his door, allowing mud to be tracked into the house. Now, the current trend of home invasions would be met with the zealous use of a shotgun. But it is not just our home that is under attack, but the whole house of Israel. Everything in the Bible is there for a reason. And the story of Phinehas is no fluke or anomaly. It's a model for the zealous believer in the God of Israel. Now, there are some detractors who would defang the principle of don't tread on me, and consider a modern-day Phinehas nothing more than a hoodlum. There's even some postulation that the seed line of Phinehas ended during the time of Eli, and therefore the everlasting covenant that God made with him was nullified. And genealogically, that may or may not be true, but that does not nullify a Christian man from being zealous in the spirit of Phinehas. But that is a very narrow view, i.e., that his seed means his descendants only, because seed can also mean his racial posterity, which we all have in common. In Gill's exposition of the entire Bible, we read, quote, "Now though Phinehas, in course, was to have the priesthood at his father's death, yet it is here promised him on account of his zeal, both to assure him that he should survive his father, and that nothing should befall him that should render him incapable of the priesthood, and moreover that he should have a seed in whom it should be continued. There was indeed an interruption of it in his line for a little while, on some account or other, it being transferred from the family of Eli, a son of Ithamar, but then it was restored again in the time of Solomon to the family of Phinehas, where it continued unto the captivity, and even to the times of Herod, and so of the Messiah. In this also, Phinehas was a type of Christ, the covenant made with him not only being from everlasting unto everlasting, a covenant that cannot be broken and will never be removed, but the priesthood founded on it is so too, being established by the oath of God who swore to him, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Christ's priesthood is an unchangeable one and does not pass from one to another. His sacrifice has a perpetual virtue and efficacy in it to take away sin, and he ever lives to make intercession for his people, because he was zealous for his God and made an atonement for the children of Israel by executing judgment upon the delinquents, as Christ has made atonement for the sins of his people by satisfying law and justice. And besides what has been observed, it may be remarked that there is an agreement between Phinehas and Christ in his very name. Phinehas signifies either the face of him that spares, that is, of God that spares. Christ is the face of God, the express image of his person, even of him who, though he spared not Christ himself, yet he spares his people for Christ's sake. Or else he shall look that spares, or, quote, and spares. That is, God who looks upon the person, righteousness, blood, and sacrifice of his son, and spares his people, end quote. What this tells me is that the priesthood of Aaron and Levi were made without an oath, but the priesthood of Phinehas and Melchizedek were both forever or everlasting. It therefore makes sense that at the time of Christ, a transition was in the works for something better, in which the spirit of Phinehas was absorbed into the order of Melchizedek. The same supernatural adjustment was made covenantally with the new covenant. Any one of us can stand our ground as Christians and execute judgment upon the delinquents, keeping our access to God open. And so the plague was stayed from the children of Israel. It doesn't necessarily have to be with a spear or violence unless there's absolutely no other remedy. And that's the storm that we are approaching, a clash between two systems of authority. The authority of Romans 13 is indeed violent in that rulers are not a terror unto good works, but to the evil. It doesn't say anything about democratic elections, but rather ministers of God that are ordained of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. That must terrify the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. I believe we are at an appointed time when those who rule over us are absolutely corrupt and void of authority. Obama certainly has no right to rule over white people. And the race traitors who made it so have no right to live in a land married to God, a Beulah land. But those mine enemies, which would not that I should reign over them, bring hither and slay them before me. Luke 19:27. The God of love said that. Now, an emasculated evangelist would say the emulation of Phineas is a sin. But what is he going to say to Jesus when he's given the command to slay? Well, Jesus, I'm not one of those terrorists or vigilantes. A race war can only be countered by a holy war. Standing your ground is not just the self-defense of an individual, but securing the life of a nation race. And thus there is a time to kill, according to Ecclesiastes 3:3, in lieu of being killed. A holy war is a white Christian man standing their ground to stop the plague, a divine cause and effect, the effect of a cowardly, tolerant people of all religions and races, is their own destruction for not being zealous for their own God. It's all right there in Deuteronomy 28, where we read about the blessings and the curses. But it shall come to pass, if thou wilt not hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God, to observe to do all his commandments and statutes, which I command thee this day, that all these curses shall come upon you. The Lord will smite thee with a botch of Egypt, and with the emerods, and with the scab, and with the itch, that whereof thou canst be healed. Now, some Christians in the health field believe this is talking about cancer. And it can't be healed with any of the AMA methods of cut, burn, or drug. And thou shalt grope at noonday as the blind gropeth in darkness, and thou shalt not prosper in thy ways. And thou shalt not only be oppressed and spoiled evermore, and no man shall save thee. Hey, how about them bailouts, huh? Thy sons and daughters shall be given to another people. A nation which thou knowest not shall eat up the fruit of thy land. Amnesty for illegal aliens. In other words, we're sick, we're broke, and we're mongrelized. This is the cause and effect of disobedience. It sounds pretty bleak and dismal, but there is a remedy. And it shall come to pass, if thou shalt hearken diligently unto the voice of thy Lord God, to observe and to do all his commandments, which I command thee this day, that the Lord thy God will set thee on high above all nations of the earth, and all these blessings shall come on thee and overtake thee, if thou shalt hearken unto the voice of the Lord thy God. Richard Hoskins said this in his book, previously cited, quote, "Only the fool ignores the Phineas priest of God." In Denver, an anti-Christian radio announcer stepped from his Volkswagen and was greeted with a hail of gunfire. In North Carolina, men entered a homosexual porno parlor, shot the occupants, and burned the parlor down on top of them. In the Midwest, interracial couples jogging together fell one after another before the carefully placed shots of a distant sniper. In Seattle, a bomb exploded in a porno movie theater. In Washington State, a Brinks car is held up and money taken to finance further acts against the establishment. In Louisiana, Vietnamese fishing boats are set aflame. In Chicago, a pedestrian draws a pistol and shoots down two assailants. In Washington, D.C., a white prostitute and her black pimp are found shot to death. It makes little difference whether you agree or disagree with the Phineas priesthood. It is important to know that it exists, is active, and in the near future may become a central fact in your life. End quote. Now, wouldn't it be ironic that those who chastise a godly priesthood as hoods were surrounded by those seeking justice for Trayvon, Negroes in hoodies from the hood, and suddenly rescued by the spirit of Phineas? Divine irony. To suggest that the priesthood of Phineas is dead is to have a death wish upon your own people. Now, I don't mean the Charles Bronson types. Every culture has their protectors and defenders. Otherwise, they'll perish. We all know Hosea 4:6, my people are destroyed for a lack of knowledge. And that vital information is withheld by the pulpits from wolves who keep the sheep passive and ready for slaughter. The last thing they want is a militant church with zealous members who are intolerant of other religions and aliens waging a race war. Knowing our identity is the first step in knowing our responsibilities. To whom much is given, much is required. In case you haven't noticed, there has been a protracted psychological warfare going on for years with a hate whitey campaign in the media, in education, and even in the churches. Lower class whites are encouraged to celebrate stupidity. You know, you're a redneck if. While the upper class are suckered into the god of materialism. Greed is good. It's not exactly breaking news, but most white people have heard that they will be a minority in their own nation in just a few decades. The cause is a preoccupation with self at every social level. Didn't Jesus say, if any man wants to follow me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me? Well, we can't bear one another's cross. Only you can crucify your own old man. But we can bear one another's burdens. In fact, we can even go further than that. There is no greater love than this, that a person would lay down his life for the sake of his friends. There's the spirit of Phineas, daring to put your life on the line regardless of the peril. God expects heroism and provides a safety net for the faithful. Whosoever shall seek to save his life shall lose it. And whosoever shall lose his life shall preserve it. As great as the dangers may be, your priority in life is not your personal safety, but rather your God-given racial consciousness. It's your spirit, not your flesh. We are the only race where eternal salvation is spoken of. The sinners of every age go on their merry way, secure in their evil ways, and remember not their latter end, unless they're perhaps a Charles Darwin or Ted Bundy making a last-minute confession, and even then only God knows the intent of their heart. But wherever the wicked are, who are marked for eternal ruin, shall be found by the judgments of God. Man-made laws can try as they will to suppress what is within the white man and makes him vessels of honor in the eyes of God. But these laws will only succeed with those who have forsaken their birthright. A new national campaign is seeking to repeal the Stand Your Ground laws, which they have sarcastically renamed Shoot First laws. Spearheaded by New York City Mayor Jew Michael Bloomberg, who has made disarmament a top priority in New York. Evidently, he and the civil rights leader Al Sharpton are not satisfied with gun control in their own state and want to stick their nose into the state rights of over 20 states who have legislation making it legal for an individual to use deadly force in public to prevent the imminent commission of a forcible felony like the violence perpetrated by Trayvon Martin. The governor of Florida has begun a task force to review public safety laws and make recommendations. Officials hope the task force will complete its work by the time of the state's next legislative session. A member of the United States Civil Rights Commission, Michael Yackey, a pro-homosexual Oriental advisor to Nancy Pelosi, does that tell you anything? said last week that he will ask the agency to investigate such laws. A bunch of unelected non-white bureaucrats are going to shoot down Stand Your Ground laws. In just the last 3 weeks, since part two of Stand Your Ground, there have been more black-on-white hate crimes that the mainstream media refuses to cover, but are clearly exposed on the internet with headlines like these. Hundreds of far-left thugs celebrate May Day with violence in Seattle. Or black school official orders police to cease arrest at violent Alabama school. Or Pearl, Mississippi, white police officer killed by a convicted black child molester. Or illegal alien kills baby, injures seven others. Or black mob brutally beat white couple in Norfolk, Virginia. Or Deltona, Florida home attacked by black mob. Or gangbangers ruin Detroit Carnival. Or three blacks arrested for a gruesome hate crime murder in Hickman County, Kentucky. Or speakers urge violence and murder at Occupy rally in D.C. But perhaps one of the most disturbing developments was the news story that Joe sent me. It reported, for the second time in a matter of a few days, blacks decided to beat up a white male for justice for Trayvon Martin. In Chicago, two black teens beat up a white male because they were mad about the Trayvon Martin case. Now, in Alabama, a gang of 20 black males beat up a white male named Matthew Owen with chairs, pipes, paint cans, and brass knuckles. As the attackers walked away, leaving Owen bleeding on the ground, one of them said, "Now that's justice for Trayvon." As usual, aside from a few local news pages, there is pure silence from the media. Obama said that if he had a son, he'd be like Trayvon Martin. But it's more likely if Obama had a son, it would look like the thugs from Chicago and Alabama. After all, Obama is nothing less than a communist thug himself and role model or poster boy for violent Negroes, the sons of perdition. Did you hear his recent announcement to launch African Americans for Obama? Speaking of blacks, he said, quote, who gave up their lives to help build a country that lived up to its founding principles. Their unwavering determination changed this country, making it possible for somebody like me to be here today. This is another moment where we've got to decide what kind of country we want to be. Say you're ready to help keep making history, end quote. Tell me this isn't in-your-face racism. What do you think would happen if Romney or some other white Republican candidate for president produced a YouTube video for all white people to unite together to elect someone of their own race? The media would go ballistic. Many of our folks in Christian Identity have heard the story of Blood River, where not one white man, woman, or child of about 500, including even several thousand of their livestock, was killed in a battle against 10,000 plus Zulu warriors in 1838 South Africa. But how many of our dearly beloved kindred have ever heard the historical account of every single white person who inhabited a particular country were murdered en masse by savage Negroes? I'm going to tell you that story today, and I hope it makes a lasting impression on your soul, because if it happened once, it can happen again. Do you remember the O.J. Simpson decision when it came down, the day the jury found him not guilty? I remember seeing blacks going ape and cheering wildly as if O.J. made a touchdown, whereas white people, reaction was that of just stunned disbelief. I believe we can draw an analogy between African Americans voting for Obama, who would likewise cheer wildly over the story of an entire white population being decimated. History is repeating itself where the herd mentality of black racism is change you can count on for reverse discrimination and wanton violence. One of the most popular books and author at the turn of the 20th century was Lathrop Stoddard, who wrote his PhD thesis on Haiti and later published it as The French Revolution in San Domingo. That country is now known as the Dominican Republic, which is the eastern half of the Caribbean island of Haiti, one of the most godforsaken places on earth. Stoddard called the Black Uprising the first shock between the ideals of white supremacy and racial equality. Columbus discovered the island in 1492, but Spain did not stay there very long, although their presence was important. They killed most of the Indians and left for more promising expeditions in Peru and Mexico, setting their livestock free. Europeans ignored the island for about a century, but settlers who came in the 1600s found an island filled with cattle and pigs and empty of hostile natives. The new arrivals to the western part were mostly buccaneers who preyed on Spanish ships and hunted the abundant wild cattle. The word buccaneer comes from the French boucaner, meaning to barbecue beef. So the next time you put a steak on the barbie, you can call yourself. As the Spanish consolidated their hold to the east, the French slowly took control of the west, which became French San Domingo. At the time of the French Revolution in 1789, French San Domingo was at its most prosperous, with over 1,000 plantations. The colony was the leading exporter of coffee, sugar, cocoa, and cotton. However, its affluence was based on a fragile racial dynamic of 40,000 whites ruling 500,000 slaves, the majority African-born. There was also an intermediate class of 27,000 mulattoes who had come about because of an initial scarcity of white women, and which would play an important role in the future of the colony. Over time, a caste system developed based on skin pigment, which was so convoluted that it was no mere demographic of just white and black, but at least six different racial forces where alliances and backstabbing would meander back and forth in vicious conflicts. Even after the arrival of French women, it was common for wealthy whites to keep mulatto mistresses. Still, the color line was well observed when it came to marriage. The few white men who married mulattoes were shunned by white society and stripped of their rights with the French government's approval. Officially classified as free people of color, mulattoes could own land, businesses, and even slaves. They despised the slaves, but resented the whites, to whom they were subordinate. Mulattoes could not vote or hold office. They were segregated in theaters, shops, churches, and even the wealthiest mulatto was the social inferior of the poorest white. Whites of all classes, as well as the authorities in France, considered the color line natural and necessary. Outnumbered 13-1 by blacks and mulattoes, whites had good reason to stay united in the face of occasional uprisings on rural plantations in which slaves slaughtered all the whites they could reach. Moreover, the French blamed the relative failure of the Spanish and Portuguese colonies for miscegenation and did not want to make the same mistake. Whites would maintain the color line at all cost, but the bitterness of the mixed race classes would soon find a sympathetic ear, or so they believed. Along comes the French Revolution in 1789 and the trepidation over revolutionary ideas entering the colony would make it possible for the people of color to take power and slaughter the whites. So the French white population took refuge in the Spanish San Domingo area, which they regarded as a reserve for the monarchy and Catholicism. From this position, they planned to prevent the triumph of subversive factions. They knew that the financiers of the revolution had its main source of income in the slave trade and the sugar market, both linked to slave labor in the French colony. And of course, it's a well-known fact that Jews were the primary entrepreneurs facilitating African slaves to the New World and the players behind a Jesuit facade in the Illuminati. To complicate matters worse, France and Spain had gone to war with each other. Behind the scenes, Spain supplied arms and ammunitions to the black generals and encouraged them in their rebellion, and thus violating their neutrality back in Europe. It was a real mess, with the French refugees counting on the help of the Spanish royalist governor, needing help against the black rebels, who had already gone out of control and had started killing white inhabitants of the French colony indiscriminately. At that point, the governor refused to help them and told them that although he had backed the black rebels who were starting to go wrong, he had to consult with the Spanish crown and added that if he sent troops, he would weaken the defenses of his own colony. That would be an easy prey for the former slaves if they decided to cross the frontier. The French exploited the latter argument precisely to persuade him to help them, telling the Dominican governor that if the French and the Spanish did not join forces to confront the black insurgents, the whole island would soon be a black possession. The Dominican authorities knew that there were many chances that the black rebels would turn against the same white people who had tried to use them for their own benefit. In that case, the Dominican authorities would send more troops to the border to avoid a black invasion of Santo Domingo and would also protect the French white monarchists that crossed that border. So they would have the perfect excuse to send troops to Santo Domingo to not only restore order, but also to restore Spanish sovereignty over that territory, which had been a Spanish colony until the French took it in the peace treaty of 1697. Negotiations between Spanish Dominicans and black generals, undertaken by a mulatto priest, offered land and freedom, which they agreed to in return for fighting the French. Initially, the white officers of the Dominican army disapproved the enrollment of former slaves that had not risen up and killed their masters. The French also tried the ploy to offer universal emancipation, but were unsuccessful. At the same time, there were internal conflicts and tensions between and within the black auxiliaries. The caste system was anything but blind. Spain and France put an end to their confrontation in Europe in 1795 with a peace treaty implying San Domingo's secession to France. But what really agitated the black slaves more than anything else was the false rumor by the Spaniards that the French king had granted the slaves a three-day holiday per week. And to put salt on the wound, after they had created the black revolutionaries, the Spanish crown planned to get rid of those troops as soon as they achieved their strategic goals. Along with the French Revolution came abolitionists of the same ilk found in America. The white colonists in San Domingo began to wonder how far these zealots would take their slogan of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Almost from the beginning, the National Assembly in Paris pushed for full citizenship rights for mulattoes. Mulattoes were emboldened and whites distressed when the Jacobins announced in 1792 they were sending a civil commission supported by 6,000 troops to San Domingo to enforce the rights of mulattoes. When the black slaves heard the news, they went into open revolt and hoped that they too would get freedom. Whites in San Domingo were therefore under siege from slaves, mulattoes, and their own government. One white who managed to return to France predicted the outcome. Quote, you may announce unreservedly that it is all over with San Domingo. One of three things will follow. The whites will exterminate the whole mulatto caste, or the mulattoes will destroy the whites, or the Negroes will profit by these dissensions to annihilate both the whites and the mulattoes. But in any case, San Domingo should be erased from the maps of France, end quote. The commission arrived and went to work, forcing whites to recognize full citizenship rights for mulattoes. The result was chaos and race war. By 1793, most whites had either been killed or fled to France or the United States. About 10,000 settled in the United States, where they were received sympathetically. Many soldiers who had accompanied the French commission also left with them rather than to help destroy their own people. With the defeat of the whites, mulattoes expected to rule in their place, expecting the labor of black slaves. But the blacks, led by General Toussaint Louverture, were supported by the French government, rose up against the mulattoes, who met the same fate as the whites. Louverture and his troops slaughtered them by the thousands. By 1801, the former slave was supreme ruler of San Domingo. He strengthened ties with the British, who helped keep his troops well-armed in exchange for supplies from the naturally rich island. In 1800, he invited whites back to the island, assuring them that they would be well-treated. A few thousand returned. He gave many back their plantations and ordered most blacks to work for the whites and for the state. The powerful military made short work of anyone who opposed this new neo-slavery. His nephew, a black general named Moise, led a revolt against these pro-white policies, and he put down the insurrection and executed his nephew. Why didn't the French take a greater role in suppressing the violence after more conservative elements regained control of Paris? In fact, Napoleon wanted to send troops, so it was stretched thin with campaigns in India and Egypt and war with Britain. In 1802, after peace with Britain, Napoleon did manage to send a force of 12,000 under Charles Leclerc with orders to take San Domingo, restore it to French rule, and arrest Louverture. Napoleon did not at first plan to reestablish slavery, but he wanted to restore French sovereignty over a white-run colony. The outnumbered French defeated the black, forcing Louverture to surrender in the spring of 1802. What appeared to be a success soon turned to failure. That summer, a great many French soldiers, as well as thousands of civilians, caught yellow fever and died. Louverture began to plot an uprising against the weakened French, but blacks, loyal to Leclerc, managed to lure him within the French lines and capture him. Leclerc packed Louverture off to jail in France, where he caught tuberculosis and died. Nevertheless, as disease continued to ravage the white troops, Leclerc began to depend increasingly on the doubtful loyalty of black generals and their followers. To Leclerc's dismay, Napoleon rescinded the ban on the slave trade and urged the reestablishment of slavery in the colonies. The black soldiers were furious, and many went into insurrection. Napoleon reestablished restrictions on mulattoes as well, something completely impossible to enforce in San Domingo, which broke down the strong antipathy between blacks and mulattoes and united them against the French. The British blockaded the island and supported the blacks and mulattoes in what was now open race war against the French. In November 1803, the French surrendered and sailed away, leaving San Domingo in the hands of Jean-Jacques Dessalines, a former slave who had been one of Louverture's generals. It is this combination of yellow fever and support from the British that accounts for the Afrocentric claim that the Black Army defeated Napoleon. Of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Dessalines, who crowned himself emperor, wanted to break all ties with France. One symbolic step was to change the name of the colony to Haiti. He guaranteed safety to the whites who remained, and even encouraged more to come. But this was a ruse. In early 1805, he ordered their extermination. A French officer who escaped described the carnage. Quote, "The murder of the whites in detail began at Port-au-Prince in the first days of January 1805, but on the 17th and 18th of March, they were finished off en masse. All, without exception, have been massacred, down to the very women and children. A young mulatto named Fifi Perisse ravaged the town like a madman, searching the houses to kill the little children. Many of the men and women were hewn down by sappers who hacked off their arms and smashed in their chest. Some were stabbed with daggers, others mutilated, others passed on the bayonet, others disemboweled with knives or sabers. Still others were stuck like pigs. The murderers were instructed to use silent weapons rather than gunfire so that the killing could be done more quietly and avoid warning intended victims by the sound of gunshots and thereby giving them the opportunity to escape. At the beginning, a great number were drowned. 800 French soldiers left behind were executed by drowning. The same general massacre has taken place all over the colony. And as I write you these lines, I believe there are not 20 whites still alive, and these not for long." End quote. With this final slaughter, French San Domingo vanished from history, and the black nation of Haiti arrived. The 1804 Haiti massacre was an ethnic cleansing, which was carried out on the remaining white population in the entire territory of Haiti from February to April, and resulted in the deaths of 3,000 to 5,000 of our kindred of all ages and gender. Haiti has made one genuinely unique gift to world culture: voodoo. Apparently, the mythic voodoo ceremony signaled the beginning of the San Domingo slave revolution. 80% of the population is Catholic, 20% are Protestant, and all 100% believe in voodoo. Up until the 1950s, Catholics tried to stamp out voodoo, but have now adopted some of its rituals. I'd like to give credit to James Libinskis with his article on the revolution in Haiti found at the American Renaissance Archives, some of which was quoted in this presentation. Well, what have we learned here today? Why didn't our people stand their ground? What was the difference between Dominican whites and the South African Boers? What was their difference in their motives for being on the land? What was their purpose in life? What was their relationship with God? Which of these two societies is America headed? Do racial realities really matter in the world today? I always try to close on a positive note, even though things seem dark and foreboding. It's been recently reported the Department of Homeland Security, an agency that says its main purpose now is to thwart homegrown terrorism, has awarded a contract to ammunition manufacturer ATK for acquiring 450 million rounds of 40 caliber hollow point ammo. One of the nation's largest suppliers of dehydrated food has cut loose 99% of their dealers and distributors, and it's not because of the economy. It's because this particular industry leader can no longer supply their regular distribution channels. Why not? Because they're using every bit of manufacturing capacity they have to fulfill massive new government contracts. The approximate tab for 420 million meals comes to about $1 billion. That's tax dollars. Factor in the media foaming at the mouth for race riots, and we have something like San Domingo. But wait, there's more. Do you know who and where the largest army is in the world? There were over 600,000 hunters this season in the state of Wisconsin. Allow me to restate that number. Over the last several months, Wisconsin hunters became the eighth largest army in the world. More men under arms than in Iran. More than France and Germany combined. These men deployed in the woods in a single American state, Wisconsin, to hunt with firearms. And no one was killed. That number pales in comparison to the 750,000 who hunted the woods in Pennsylvania and Michigan, 700,000 hunters, all of whom have now returned home safely. Toss in 250,000 hunters in West Virginia, and it literally establishes the fact that hunters of those four states alone would comprise the largest army in the world. And then add in the total number of hunters in the other 46 states, it's 1 million or more. The point? America will be safe forever from foreign invasions with that kind of homegrown firepower. Hunting. It's not just a way to fill the freezer anymore. It's a matter of national security. That's why all the enemies, foreign and domestic, want to see us disarmed. In that regard, let us turn to the Bible, which is the owner's manual for the white race, and read some hope for the situation. Five of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight, and your enemies shall fall by the sword. With that thought, we will stand our ground just fine. Amen.